Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today I'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with news that the new Attorney General, William Barr, is preparing to release the Mueller report as early as next week, but may hold back the results of the two-year-long investigation until after Trump meets with the North Korean dictator in Hanoi. Asha Rangappa, a lecturer at the Jackson Institute for Global Affairs at Yale University, who served as an FBI counterintelligence agent in New York City and is now a legal and national security analyst at CNN, joins us to discuss a number of breaking stories surrounding Trump and Russian collusion. We'll assess whether the Mueller report could be that close to being released to the Congress, not the public, given the enormous trove of information recently scooped up with the arrest of Roger Stone, and also look into the New York Times investigation of how Trump has been trying to thwart the Mueller probe behind the scenes, going as far as ordering the acting Attorney General Whitaker to assign a Trump-friendly U.S. attorney to the Cohen case in the Southern District of New York. Then there is the explosive remark by the former acting FBI Director Andrew McCabe that it is possible Trump is a Russian asset. And finally, there are concerns that Trump may soon fire the Director of National Intelligence, Dan Coats, who recently testified before the Senate Intelligence Committee on the threats facing America, but did not include Trump's made-up invasion on our southern border. And he contradicted Trump's ridiculous claim his bromance with the North Korean dictator has led to nuclear disarmament. Then, with Putin's annual State of the Nation address today, we'll get an assessment of the nuclear saber-rattling on display with Cold War-like threats from Putin to target American decision-making centers with brand-new invincible Russian nukes. Nina Kusheva, a professor of international affairs at the New School and the author of the new book just out, In Putin's Footsteps, Searching for the Soul of an Empire Across Russia's 11 Time Zones, joins us to discuss her journey across a far more diverse and complex country than the one depicted as the looming threat led by a diabolical evil genius in the Kremlin. Then finally, we will examine the recent revelations in the press that the prestigious worldwide consulting firm of McKinsey & Company has been involved in nefarious activities such as helping a state-owned Chinese firm build an artificial island in the South China Sea, helping Purdue Pharma boost its sales of OxyContin while countering the DEA's efforts to reduce opioid use, and operating a secretive hedge fund involving conflicts of interest. James Henry, the former chief economist at McKinsey & Company, and Caitlin Rosenthal, a former consultant with the firm, join us to explore why and how much the company went off the rails. And before we begin today's program, I want to thank listeners like you who are helping us build a new home online at backgroundbriefing.org. We encourage you to bookmark our new website and join the community of listeners we are building nationwide with your support at backgroundbriefing.org/donate to keep us independent and free from corporate sponsors so that we can continue to provide breaking news analysis from the most knowledgeable guests we can find as we build a reality-based community in post-truth America. And joining us now is Asha Rangappa, who is a lecturer at the Jackson Institute for Global Affairs at Yale University, and she previously served as a special agent at the Federal Bureau of Investigation specializing in counterintelligence investigations in New York City and is now a legal and national security analyst at CNN. Welcome to Background Briefing, Asha Rangappa.
Thank you for having me.
And there's been quite a bit of breaking news today. The most explosive, or I guess newsworthy, if you will, is that the Attorney General Bill Barr is now preparing to announce as early as next week that the Mueller investigation has been completed and that he will submit it to Congress soon. That, of course, doesn't mean that the public will see it, and it doesn't mean that it will get to Congress because he's basically, under the statute, I believe, he has to approve it first. So let's start with that. What's your sense of this two-year investigation? Do you think it is likely to be over?
I have to be honest, I am surprised to hear this, and I base that mainly on things that we know from the court filings that Mueller has done so far. We know, for example, that Michael Cohen, Trump's personal attorney, was continuing to provide information on ongoing investigations. We also know that Michael Flynn, Trump's national security advisor, had his sentencing delayed or postponed in order to continue to provide information on ongoing investigations. So, and then also just now, Roger Stone was arrested not very long ago, where they seized several terabytes of information from his computers and devices, and actually requested a delay on the trial in order to go through it. So it seemed like there were still a lot of outstanding threads, and I think the idea that Mueller has completely wrapped up has been very puzzling to us legal watchers.
So would it be possible then to release the Mueller report in sections, starting with an executive summary of what he's done so far, even if these loose ends are out there, with, particularly with Roger Stone?
It's possible. That is not what the reporting seems to be suggesting. So first, I think that, you know, in terms of segmenting the investigation, I think that there are really only two segments. One is the obstruction of justice investigation against the president, and the other is into Russian collusion between the Trump campaign and Russia. So, you know, theoretically, he might be wrapping up just the obstruction investigation. I mean, that would be possible. But again, what is being suggested is that he is really wrapping up the whole thing, and that it's not really about just providing a report on the obstruction piece.
And again, I'm speaking with Asha Rangappa, who's a lecturer at the Jackson Institute for Global Affairs at Yale University. She previously served as a special agent at the Federal Bureau of Investigation, specializing in counterintelligence investigations in New York City, and is now a legal and national security analyst at CNN. The other story that's breaking, or broke yesterday with the New York Times, is the extent to which behind the scenes Donald Trump has been trying to thwart all of these investigations, and he even went so far as to task the acting Attorney General Whitaker to essentially reassign the AUSAs in the Southern District of New York to get his U.S. attorney overseeing the Cohen case, presumably to make it less damaging. That particular U.S. attorney apparently had already accused himself, and I guess that got Whitaker off the hook. But obviously, all of these developments are pretty troubling, aren't they?
They are definitely troubling. They add to the pattern that we've already been seeing for the last 2 years in the public sphere. And I think what they suggest is a continued pattern of trying to obstruct justice, of trying to make these investigations go away or place people who he believes are loyal to him in a position to stymie the investigation. So for sure, I think these are, you know, troubling revelations, but at the same time, in my opinion, not entirely shocking or surprising.
Well, what is extraordinary, though, is that President Trump even today tweeted out saying that the New York Times reporters didn't check with him. He said it's all a lie, it's fake news, etc. And Maggie Haberman, one of the journalists who wrote the story, just said bluntly on CNN, that's a lie. So what is the tactic here? Is President Trump just simply able to lie in a bald-faced way on the understanding that people inside his world that watch Fox News will believe him and not anything else? Is, you know, are we stuck with this he said, she said dynamic forever, or at least until 2020?
Well, I think so. We know at this point that Trump lies very frequently. I think that Daniel Dale, who's a Toronto Star reporter, has actually been keeping track, and his lies per week have quadrupled since last year. Daniel Dale said that he is averaging about 18 falsehoods per week. So we are at a point where the president is going to say things that are just simply not true, and I think it becomes harder to credit his version of events, and I don't see why Maggie Haberman, a New York Times reporter, would need to lie about that. I think the bigger picture here is that what we're seeing is really, either consciously or unconsciously, a replica of a Russian disinformation technique, which is to confuse the public. So when you don't want the public to really believe a set of facts, in some places that have authoritarian governments, you can suppress that information. You can shut journalists down or kill them. Obviously, in the United States, that's not an option. So what's the next best thing? You throw a lot of other conflicting information out there so that the public literally begins to not know what version of facts to believe. And I think the fact that he needs to do that suggests that he cannot win on a legitimate argument. It has to be kind of obfuscation and, you know, lying and confusing the public. And to me, that in and of itself is telling.
Well, what I find really kind of incriminating is that the people that Trump has fired and gone after and demonized in the FBI, starting with Andrew McCabe, who's now on a book tour. But if you look at the other people that he went after, Bruce Orr, Peter Strzok, Lisa Page, etc., all of them, except perhaps Lisa Page, from my understanding, the FBI's top agents in terms of monitoring and investigating Russian organized crime. And as you know, Russian organized crime and intelligence have merged under Putin. And that in itself is scary. We've never had the combination of national security and organized crime, nuclear weapons and the mafia. But that's what we have in Russia. But I find it very, very coincidental, shall we say, that the people that Trump has gone after are the ones that know the most about Russia. And is there a connection there, do you think?
Well, I think that it gets to a point where it becomes harder to suggest that it is a coincidence. These are the people who would be in the best position to really know and expose Trump's dealings and also Putin's actions. So I think that they are definitely the people that he would be the most concerned about. I mean, I think the part that he doesn't seem to understand is you can get rid of the people, but you cannot get rid of evidence or what is collected in cases. And, you know, in FBI investigations, every investigative step is conducted by at least two agents in order to basically insulate against this kind of thing, that if the credibility of one agent that has been on a particular investigation or collecting a particular piece of evidence is somehow called into question, there is someone else there to, you know, vouch for it. And also, these are not, they don't go away. FBI files are essentially tamper-proof. They're digital at this point. You can't get rid of it. And I'm not sure that he fully understands that he can get rid of as many people as he wants, but the facts that have been collected will always remain there to be picked up by someone else. It's kind of like a hydra.
Mm-hmm. Just to wrap up in the last couple of minutes here, there's so much to report on Usher Rangappa, but Andrew McCabe, speaking on CNN to Anderson Cooper, was asked, do you think the president could be a Russian asset? To which he replied, I think it's possible. I think that's why we started our investigation, and I'm really anxious to see where Special Counsel Robert Mueller concludes that. Now, that's getting a lot of attention, obviously. But, you know, the former DNI, Clapper, said that he thinks that Vladimir Putin is Donald Trump's case officer. So, I mean, how many times do these senior intelligence officials have to flash the red light, for God's sake?
Yeah, I mean, it's a big question. And I think one of the things that actually helps Trump in all of this, whether it's the criminal activity, the obstruction, the, you know, acting basically in Russian interests over those of the United States, is that he does it in the light of day. I mean, he's doing it in his tweets. He did it in Helsinki. He comes out very unabashedly. He says, like, I'm going to fire my AG, you know, when Attorney General Jeff Sessions was in place. And I think we have, you know, we're kind of socialized to believe that when people are doing really bad things, they're doing them in secret. And so when someone's doing it completely in public, psychologically, I think it kind of convinces people that it can't be really that bad. So you have intelligence officials who are looking at this and saying, this is still obstruction. This is still, you know, problematic from a national security perspective. He appears to be doing Putin's will, but I think that for the general public, it becomes harder to accept the conclusions because somehow the very brazenness of Trump's activities lessen their impact.
Well, just in closing, it looks as though Trump is laying the groundwork to fire the Director of National Intelligence, Dan Coats. What do you think that means, and who could possibly replace him? If you get, you know, if you get a Whitaker in there, would the intelligence community have to swallow that?
Well, the intelligence community, the DNI is relatively new. Let's remember that. That was something that was created in the wake of 9/11. And really, it was James Clapper who solidified that role as something that actually had a coordinating authority over all the intelligence agencies. But the individual agencies still operate under their respective directors, the FBI under Christopher Wray, the CIA under Gina Haspel. And so, you know, I think that, unfortunately, if you were to hire somebody who or appoint someone who was not qualified or some kind of lackey, what it would mean is that there would be less respect accorded to that person, perhaps less coordination among the agencies, but I think the agencies themselves would still continue to operate within their missions.
Well, Asharan Gupra, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you so much.
And again, I've been speaking with Asharan Gupra, who is a lecturer at the Jackson Institute for Global Affairs at Yale University. Previously, she served as a special agent at the Federal Bureau of Investigation, specializing in counterintelligence investigations in New York City, and is now a legal and national security analyst at CNN. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into Putin's annual State of the Nation address with the granddaughter of the former Soviet leader, Nikita Khrushchev.
From Russia with love, I fly to you, much wiser since my goodbye to you.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Nina Khrushcheva, who is a professor in the Graduate Program of International Affairs at the New School and a senior fellow at the World Policy Institute. She's also an editor of and a contributor to Project Syndicate and the author of The Lost Khrushchev, A Journey into the Gulag of the Russian Mind. And her latest book, just out, co-authored with Jeffrey Taylor, is In Putin's Footsteps, Searching for the Soul of an Empire Across Russia's 11 Time Zones. Welcome to Background Briefing, Nina Khrushcheva.
Thank you.
And before we get into a discussion about your book and your journey across Russia's 11 time zones, today, Wednesday, President Putin delivered his State of the Nation address. And this year, he basically has told the Russian people that they should feel changes for the better. But he also warned the United States of a resolute response if the U.S. decides to station missiles in countries neighboring Russia, I guess like Poland. And this, of course, is in response to the U.S. pulling out of the INF Treaty. Just to quote Putin today, it's their right to think how they want, but can they count? I'm sure they can. Let them count the speed and the range of the weapon systems we are developing. He sort of made, a kind of dig at Bolton. But some of this talk now sort of is reminiscent of the tit-for-tat in the Cold War, even though Putin said that the Russians were looking for a mirror-like response to the U.S. and would not get involved in a costly arms race. I don't see whether that How can you respond without getting into a costly arms race?
Well, and he already explained that, you know, Russia is developing those weapons and Russia will respond in kind. And that is certainly the conversation that the leaders had during the Cold War, because either both sides were saying, well, we are not, we're only preparing defensive weapons, or we are, whatever weapons we are preparing is only in response because the other side is unreasonable, the other side is bellicose, and we don't want war, we want peace, but we have to prepare for war. So in this sense, it's certainly a reminder of old threats, but it's not necessarily that unusual, because kind of the conversation who can do more harm to another side and arguing that one side is a victim of another has been going on at least since the middle 2000s with the kind of greater degree of animosity talk or less, and certainly much more since Russia annexed Crimea in 2014. So it is, but I mean, I would certainly kind of looking at it as a threat to the United States, it is not, but it's certainly is a firm response to the United States. And I think that's kind of a Putin trick generally, is that he essentially says, well, we're not being your enemy, but if you want to have us as your enemy, we're very welcoming that decision. And it gives him, as you mentioned, it gives him kind of a way out with the Russian people, is saying, well, we're trying to get better life for you, but look at those Americans. Their argument is always against us, and there is nothing we can do but develop the military equipment.
Well, it is reminiscent, though, of back in the Cold War, when President Reagan talked of the evil empire and Russia ending up on the ash heap of history. Andropov and company did take that literally. After all, they had a system that was built on rhetoric rather than reality. And remember, Cap Weinberg, the Secretary of Defense under Reagan, talked about nuclear decapitation, which I'm sure Andropov and company took quite personally. So when Putin said today that he would field new weapons that would target U.S. decision-making centers, is that reminiscent of Reagan's taunting the wounded bear?
Well, American rhetoric is also very reminiscent of that taunted wounded bear. So in this sense, Putin is responding to what he's hearing from, say, John Bolton. So as I said, I mean, it is reminiscent and it is tit for tat, and we are not saying that we are threatening you, but certainly we are going to reply with a threat. And of course, when the United States declared that it's going to withdraw from the INF treaty, it gave Putin an absolute opportunity to kind of talk about Russia as a victim of the potential United States aggression. So, you know, the way America saw the evil empire in the Soviet Union, Putin has an argument that, you know, America is an unreasonable empire because it doesn't want any conversation, because they treat us as if we are enemies just by definition. So we'll see. I think generally, to your point of the rhetoric, I don't know. We actually not sure how strong those weapons are that Putin keeps promising we have. And we know from various accounts from recent years that some of them, you know, don't start up or don't stop and whatnot. So a lot of it is sort of North Korean type show. Some of them, I'm sure, work, and some of them, as we know, were tested in Syria. But how truly dangerous they are, that's a question. But what I find very alarming, even more so than the withdrawal from the INF treaty, is that the rhetoric that both sides use or continue to use or kind of escalate in using can actually bring to escalation of weapons when they're not going to be produced for show, but actually going to be produced for targeting each other. And I think, I do hope that both sides have some sort of policy rather than rhetoric to make sure they confront that.
Well, Putin concluded his address, delivering his State of the Nation address today in Moscow, by saying that Russia would always make sure it is secure. And he said the country would be ready for further talks on arms control, but would not keep knocking on a locked door. So he does have a way with words, doesn't he?
And he's been very talented with that. I mean, we talked about it on this program, I think, many times, is that he knows how to deliver a line, and he does sound convincing, he can even be kind of forceful and charming at the same time on the level of, say, the great political charmer such as Bill Clinton.
Right.
So he's very good at those things, and he's very good at delivering calm firmness so that steely KGB eyes certainly kind of often happen to be successful in mesmerizing the nation. So, and it was not also necessarily a very wordy address, unlike his other appearances. So it was forceful in its delivery, and from what I'm seeing in response, the response has been pretty positive.
In Russia, you mean?
In Russia, yes.
Yeah,
in Russia.
Because compared to our president and his recent Rose Garden rambling display of an incomprehensible word salad, there's a pretty stark contrast there. And again, I'm speaking with Nina Khrushcheva, professor in the graduate program of international affairs at the New School and a senior fellow at the World Policy Institute. She's also an editor of and a contributor to Project Syndicate and the author of The Lost Khrushchev, A Journey into the Gulag of the Russian Mind. And her latest book, just out, co-authored with Jeffrey Taylor, is In Putin's Footsteps, Searching for the Soul of an Empire Across Russia's 11 Time Zones. So, Jeffrey Taylor, he's an American journalist working in Moscow, right?
Yes, he's living in Moscow for over 25 years, years, I think.
And you set out together to retrace Putin's footsteps, not literally, but in terms of the New Year's address that Putin promised, where he would make a New Year's address every hour across the time zones.
Yes, it was kind of a very, very bold but completely impossible idea because, you know, Russia is a big country and Putin is very proud of Russia being such a big country, and he thought he would highlight it in his address to the nation, something that every president, every leader, Soviet leader also did or do in the New Year's. It's like dropping the ball in Times Square in America. It's such an important event. There, the president speaks to the nation and how, you know, wishing it's all best in the new year. So Putin wanted to do it from each time zone and stopping there every hour in the hour. But he couldn't do it physically because it is 11 time zones. It's a big country. You can do it in a magic sleigh. You can't really do it in a regular, even presidential airplane. And so we thought it would be an interesting idea to actually go through all the time zones and see how different, diverse and great or not great the country really is, and how country changes, because it is. It takes almost the whole continent from Kamchatka, from the Pacific Ocean, where, as you memorably probably remember, Sarah Palin said that she sees Putin in her backyard. That's what she's seeing. She's seeing the Kamchatka Peninsula to all the way to Kaliningrad, which used to be German city of Königsberg, which was the Soviet took over from the Germans after World War II. So we wanted to see how landscape changes, how people change, how military-industrial complex changes, how soft power changes, you know, the trade power from the West. And we went because we believe that Russia's definition of itself actually is a Western definition, despite all this saber-rattling. And so we went from Kaliningrad, former Königsberg in Germany, now part of Russia, all the way to the Pacific Ocean.
And is there a comparison in the sense that Donald Trump's political strength are in the rural red states, which are very thinly populated and very kind of religious, etc.? It does seem that Putin also has a lot of support in the rural, sparsely populated areas where the Orthodox Church is very strong. Not that it's not strong across Russia in general, but can you make a comparison there?
To some degree, but Putin is popular everywhere, and not popular everywhere, so that you can find people who are very critical of him and sort of or surrender to the rule, because in many places life did become better. I mean, cities do get, I mean, cities became, many cities have become comfortable, which really Russia never had. There was no such thing as a comfortable Russian city, and that's why before it was always sort of either Moscow or Leningrad or St. Petersburg. They were better handled. But now you go to cities like Omsk or Sverdlovsk, where Boris Yeltsin, the first Russian president, was born, and they're incredibly comfortable, well-equipped cities. So you can find support for Putin everywhere. In Kaliningrad, in the most western enclave, in fact, he is rather popular because that kind of rhetoric of animosity that the West is out to get us works there as well. And there are as many critics of him as there are supporters in Kaliningrad. So to some degree, you can say that the more rural you go, the more pro-Kremlin they would be, not necessarily pro-Putin, but pro-Kremlin. But I think it would be a simplistic way of looking at it. It's just, I think what matters, not that they are necessarily pro-Putin, but in some places, the kind of in deep Russia, if there is such a thing, nowadays, the protest culture is different. It's not that they're supporting Putin, but they're less likely to go and unsupport him. While in big cities, and the bigger the city, the more central, the more western the city is, the more protests they will be. But then, of course, that is Kaliningrad, where protests are not that strong. So it's less. Well, but in America, it's also not necessarily, you know, the middle of America is all red and
it's true.
The ocean parts are left.
Right. But Nina, that is what's so wonderful about your book is that, and that's why, for example, Jack McLaught, who was the U.S. ambassador to the USSR at the time of its transition, he wrote Reagan and Gorbachev, How the Cold War Ended. He says it's an absorbing read, which is also the most insightful book I've read about Putin's Russia. It is essential reading for anyone desiring to understand Russia and should be required for everyone presuming to comment on Russia today. And, you know, I'm guilty of that, just trying to cover Russia. And I've always had an affection for Russia, having worked on nuclear arms control during the Cold War. But I know I'm not getting it right. So are we doomed in America never to understand Russia?
Well, but I don't think, I mean, I'm sure Jeffrey and I would also think, I mean, I don't know about Jeffrey, but I'm pretty sure that we also don't think we get it right. I mean, we get it as right as we can, and that's why we want to see what Russia is. And unlike Jeffrey, who actually traveled not all across all time zones, but in many more places than I have before this trip, so I wanted to see what's right and what's not. And it's like every country, it is complicated, and it's not all about the Kremlin. Russia is much bigger than the Kremlin. That's why I'm so slightly hesitant to say, well, deep Russia all supports Putin. It's not the case. It's difficult. You can't, I mean, it is, once again, I mean, that's why we were so interested in this, is it's 11 time zones. I mean, one time zone cannot be explained in, you know, 5 seconds or less on a radio show or TV show, and even in an article, let alone 11. It is, so nobody can get it right, as nobody, I think, can get America right in kind of a very quick look. But I think we're trying to decipher. I mean, for us, the most important question wasn't something that you and I discuss on your program often, is that the question of power. You know, what it is that makes Russia Russia, that certain type of power is being more welcome than another type of power. And we look at that in the book. It's not just in Putin's footsteps. It's also in the footsteps of Lenin and Stalin and Khrushchev and Brezhnev and all the tsars that came before. So I think kind of trying to understand it in a multifaceted way is something that we aspired, and we're very honored by Jack Matlock's assessment. But once again, understanding that nobody can get it right, I think is something sort of humbling, and we all should follow that humble assessment, because countries are complex, and even speaking the language doesn't necessarily always mean that you know exactly what it is you're talking about.
But just in closing, I understand that when Barack Obama described Russia as a regional power, that really got under Putin's skin. And isn't there, I guess it's always been a way that the, going back to the Tsarist through the Soviet and into the new Russia, there's always been this sense of wanting to portray Russia as a formidable nation. And of course, there's no question that Putin does beat that drum, particularly with the nuclear build-up that he's talking about, etc. So what's in there? Is there a kind of, while you can accuse the United States of exceptionalism, which Putin does often, American exceptionalism, in Russia
he
there's
just
a...
He did it in the speech.
Right, he did it in the speech. But, in contrast, I get the impression that Russian exceptionalism comes from sort of having a chip on your shoulder.
Well, maybe, but it also sees itself an exceptional nation. I mean, we know it's essentially both countries are frontier because they're on the frontier of European world. They're both imitation because ultimately they imitate Europe and its developments, and they're both messianic and kind of promote America promotes comfort, if to simplify, and Russia promotes the kind of great understanding of human soul. But in many ways, they are similar in that idea that they know something that others do not. And so Putin's chip on his shoulder comes from the fact that he believes that the West doesn't understand that Russia stands on the same level as great power. So he was very upset about the regional power. And one of the reasons actually we wanted to see is that what does it mean when you have such an enormous territory and so many borderlands, what does it mean to be a regional power? And what we've discovered that, you know, to say the America sneezes, the world catches a cold, Russia sneezes, the world catches a cold. I mean, there is no way of denying it. And so one of the things that we discovered is that, regional or not, by the time we came back to Moscow, we thought, well, if we didn't know that before, and traveling like that, if I were Putin, I was saying, I would think I'm God. So when he's not treated like God, when he's not treated like equal, of course he gets very testy and upset, and says, well, you know, we are as important as the Western world. And in fact, to conclude, that's why we started our journey in Kaliningrad, in the most Western part of it, because ultimately Russia is a Western country that, to your chip on the shoulder, that is afraid that it cannot compete on general terms with the West, so it becomes something else. It becomes the Great Russia, but all its definition of itself is absolutely Western.
Well, Nina Khrushcheva, thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
And again, I mean, speaking with Nina Khrushcheva, who is a professor in the Graduate Program of International Affairs at the New School and a senior fellow at the World Policy Institute. She's also an editor of and a contributor to Project Syndicate and the author of The Lost Khrushchev, A Journey into the Gulag of the Russian Mind. And her latest book, just out, co-authored with Jeffrey Taylor, is In Putin's Footsteps, Searching for the Soul of an Empire Across Russia's 11 Time Zones. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back examining the recent revelations in the press that the prestigious worldwide consulting firm of McKinsey & Company has been involved in nefarious activities.
Bermuda in the Bahamas.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24-7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is James Henry, an economist, lawyer, and investigative journalist who has written extensively about global banking, debt crises, tax havens, and economic development. The former chief economist at McKinsey & Company, he's the co-founder with David K. Johnston of the new investigative reporting news service, dcreport.org, and is the author of Blood Bankers. And also joining us is Caitlin Rosenthal, a professor of history at the University of California, Berkeley, who researches the development of management practices, especially those based on data analysis. Previously a consultant with McKinsey & Company, she's the author of Accounting for Slavery, Masters in Management, and has an article at the Washington Post, The Perils of Big Data, How Crunching Numbers Can Lead to Moral Blunders. Welcome to Background Briefing, James Henry and Caitlin Rosenthal.
Thanks very much.
So let me begin
with
you.
Thank you,
Caitlin. Let me begin with you, Caitlin. You also were previously with McKinsey & Company as a consultant, and Jim was their former chief economist. So what is this story, essentially, that's breaking now, this damning new report that says McKinsey & Company allegedly, among other things, helped produce, sell even more opioids?
So I should clarify my own expertise. I'm a McKinsey alum, but from more than a decade ago. And I've been reading these stories as they break, really with the interest of someone who enjoyed working at McKinsey and cares a lot about whether the firm continues to do good work. And I understand that McKinsey at some point gave some advice to Purdue Pharma, encouraging them and offering some strategies for how to sell more products.
And
my own expertise is as a business historian, and I'm interested in kind of how the history of people being involved in morally and ethically charged situations can help to inform how to think about these modern challenges.
And Jim, as an alum, how do you see these reports coming out about helping Purdue and also selling advice to hedge funds, et cetera?
Well, I've been engaged with the two journalists at the Times who started writing about a series of McKinsey stuff. Michael Forsyth and Walter Bogdanovich. They're both very reputable reporters. And about a year or so ago, they called me up and said, you know, we're working on this stuff about McKinsey's role in South Africa. And it just so happened that I was doing a case study of that. I guess I'm more concerned, actually, about the behavior of the firm in developing countries like South Africa, where they were tagged with paying bribes to get consulting contracts, and Saudi Arabia, where they have done more than 600 studies for the crown prince to help him with his 2030, you know, economic plan. I mean, that's a shameful regime to be, I think, that closely involved in. They've also worked closely in China. So, you know, it's really the business of having taken on assignments in these, with respect to these developing countries and their misbehavior there. The case of the opioid consulting and the business about their operating this hedge fund offshore, these are a first world cases. And the McKinsey that we knew and loved back in the 1980s and early 90s, I think, was a firm that's very scrupulous, I think, in terms of its management practices. And you know, I think many alums that I've talked to are just, at least those who remember that period when Marvin Bower, the founder of the firm, was around, are really appalled that this has gone on and that McKinsey has kind of become unrecognizable in some ways. There's some interesting theories to account for that change, and we could get into that, but
well, let me
ask my first reaction.
But let me ask Caitlin, though, just to let our audience know what the company does, at least in terms of its original mission and how it may be transgressed.
So, I mean, I was at McKinsey a little bit later than that. But when I was there, it was a firm that I thought took a lot of care in selecting clients and in pursuing client service. I was a business analyst and also a member of the Community Fellows Program that was interested in doing social sector and public sector work, often work that had missions that were both about making the world better and also about earning for the firm. But I was, kind of there at a time where values loomed really large. I can't speak to how the firm has changed, but well, really to my own my experience there.
Well, tell us then about how your time at McKinsey inspired you to study the history of quantitative management and the ethical challenges it creates, and how that led you to study the history of American and Atlantic slavery.
Absolutely. There's one thing that I really took away from my time at McKinsey was that there were perils of doing business with data and doing business at a distance. I had the experience of kind of parachuting into clients and inheriting a spreadsheet, doing calculations, and calculations about workers who I often didn't meet and who, you know, weren't the ongoing responsibility of the firm. And in that context, I think it becomes easier to make ethically problematic decisions. So I went to graduate school interested in studying scale and the history of data and how business changes when we think about workers as entries in a spreadsheet instead of as individuals. And that surprisingly led me to the history of American and Atlantic slavery. I found that some of the most sophisticated records of the 19th century and the most data-driven ones were records kept by slaveholders. And many of these slaveholders are doing business at a distance. They're doing business within an empire, so in a developing world context like the one James just referenced. And this leads them to do a lot of things that look very sophisticated and advanced and high-tech, but also things that are morally reprehensible and go along with extreme amounts of brutality and violence.
And James, Henry, tell us about the story of McKinsey & Company's secretive hedge fund that had investments in Puerto Rico's debt at the same time it was advising Puerto Rico on trying to get rid of the debt.
Well, hedge fund that McKinsey set up, you know, it's not unique on Wall Street. I mean, most investment banks have these things, and they are advising clients at the same time investing in their securities. But I think what this underscores, McKinsey is by now accumulated a hedge fund with about $12 billion of net client assets, $25 billion or so of gross client assets around the world, all of which is owned on the behalf of its partners. And it's managed out of an island in the Channel Islands called Guernsey, which is a tax haven. The only reason you would set up in a tax haven is to basically facilitate tax dodging on the part of some of the investors. And under regulation. So it's really kind of unseemly. I mean, this is entirely new behavior. This has gone on since 2000. I think what's gone on at McKinsey is that they developed under a previous managing director, Raj Gupta specifically, who you know, served time for insider trading in 2012, kind of an appetite to, you know, they were looking over their shoulders at the investment banks and how much money they were making. And, you know, they decided to cross the line from being a provider of consulting services and strategic consulting at the top management level over into having their own investment portfolio and then also, you know, behaving more and more like a risk-taking investment bank in terms of getting involved with dodgy clients. I mean, when I was there, I was always impressed with how many times we would refuse client engagements that were not ethical. Or on the other side, we would engage in public service. We would be, you know, tasked to help the city of New York figure out, you know, its investment strategy. Or we would be helping the government of Tanzania decentralize. Or, you know, clients that barely could pay their way, but you were doing it for the public interest. And that was the McKinsey that I think we were all surprised to find was, you know, has been kind of shunted aside in this latest, really, by now, I mean, 6 or 8 separate stories that the New York Times has written about all these different kinds of misbehavior, from conflicts of interest in bankruptcy cases to the hedge fund, to the opioid case, to the engagements in China and Saudi Arabia and South Africa. So, you know, I think it's time for alumni who care about the firm to get engage with them and say, what the heck is going on?
So, Caitlin,
it's actually damaging our reputations as well.
So, Caitlin, I don't know whether you feel the same way as James, that somehow your association with it has tainted you, but isn't there a fundamental problem that you have working for a company that does consulting work? There must be a natural tendency to tell the company you're consulting for what they want to hear as opposed to what they need to hear? How do you thread that needle?
Well, I think that these are problems that McKinsey faces, but they're also much, much broader problems. And I see them as coming in part from consulting. Consulting offers a certain distance that I think lets them people distance themselves from moral responsibility, where if you're giving advice or consulting or advocating for a client, you're not the person making decisions and therefore not fully responsible. But I also think that these are perils of, kind of the environment in which we're doing business and the kind of assumption that doing well and doing good go hand in hand. I hear people talk about doing well and doing good together, and that was a really common thing to talk about at McKinsey. And I think people have that aspiration, but something shifted that led people to think that there was something automatic about that. That if you're doing well, then somehow you're going to be doing good. If you're applying advanced and innovative practices, then somehow economic liberalization and things like that are going to go along with it, and democratization. And a lot of those assumptions are faulty. So you can only do good by doing well by being very critical and selective about the kinds of work that you do. When a consulting firm prioritizes client service, if you're going to prioritize that as the very number one value that you pursue, then you have to be very choosy about what kinds of clients you work for and what kind of work that you do. Otherwise, you're going to compromise your other values.
But don't quite often corporations use consulting firms to deliver bad news? Like if they want to fire a bunch of people, they don't want to do it themselves. They hire somebody else to be the hatchet person.
So I think that there can be cases like that. And in some cases, consulting firms can help businesses to make difficult decisions that they indeed need to make and decisions that might not be unethical. I also share the bigger concern when the person hiring the consulting firm is an authoritarian government or is in a context where corruption is the norm. Businesses sometimes have to downsize. They sometimes have to do things that are unpleasant, and they can make those choices in ethical ways. The real concern to me in the recent stories is about McKinsey being willing to overlook unethical contexts along the way.
Well, there are some pretty bad examples, and I'll ask you about them, Jim. McKinsey's also did consulting with a state-owned client to help build China's artificial islands in the South China Sea that have become very contentious. They also, you mentioned Mohammed bin Salman in Saudi Arabia doing his Vision 2030 program, consulting with Erdogan, the sort of emerging dictator now in Turkey. And, of course, consulting for Ukraine under Yanukovych and South Africa and Russia as well. So that's a pretty grim list, is it not, Jim?
Well, I think it is, and it reflects kind of this, hypothesize that in the rush for growth and the perception of competition, McKinsey has basically given up some of the principles that we were always... I mean, I was struck when I was at the firm by the number of cases in which we would basically tell the client just the opposite of what his preferred preferences or her preferred preferences were going in. I mean, we had a strong commitment to the truth and also not accepting assignments just for the sake of money, making money. The great strength of the firm was, they could afford McKinsey. You could afford to be different. We could afford to tell the truth and we could afford to walk away and refuse to be rubber stamping some CEO's preferences. I mean, I came up with a case in which we discovered the CEO of a major paper company had his own private golf course and his own private farm. nobody knew about it. We opened the case, and he basically had to fess up before the board, and the firm stood behind me on that. In this situation, in let's say the Chinese state-owned companies, it's partly a reflection of the fact that the world has changed. We now have major kleptocracies like China, to some extent Russia, but non-democratic countries where Turkey, where the rule of law and journalists are in jail. I mean, those are major markets, and they've been growing pretty fast. China is close to being the world's largest economy and the largest trading partner for the United States. So you have to choke card on the question of whether you can afford to walk away from the Chinese government on these studies. I sympathize with McKinsey's dilemma, but I still think in the long run it will pay off if it's working for democratic states where there's the rule of law.
Well, just in closing, Caitlin Rosenthal, back to the accusations about McKinsey's consulting on the opioid crisis with Purdue Pharma. Basically, it's a pretty damning picture because it reveals that Purdue Pharma was helped by McKinsey to turbocharge sales of OxyContin and to counter efforts by drug enforcement agents to reduce opioid use. And then when the epidemic, which is ongoing, became apparent and was publicized, again, the consulting firm of McKinsey reportedly helped Purdue counter, quote, the emotional messages from mothers with teenagers who had overdosed and died. So how do they get out from under that?
So the story makes me really uncomfortable, and my biggest hope coming out of it is that stories like this that make the firm uncomfortable are going to lead it to be more critical about what kinds of work it takes. I think it's just too easy to think that your role in a project is merely to provide the best path to profit. And if that's all you do, it can lead in all kinds of problematic directions. I mean, for me, as someone working on the history of slavery and the history of the business of slavery, I think that's the biggest value in studying the business history of slavery is that it makes people uncomfortable. And it sees that advanced and highly profitable practices can go hand in hand with things that we can't excuse. And that's the kind of discomfort that I can hope will be lead the firm to be more selective in its decisions about what kinds of business to do.
And James Henry, a quick last word from you.
I think Caitlin is absolutely right. You know, there's a lot of pressures on U.S. institutions these days and institutions like McKinsey to accept concessions, make concessions. I was just up at Harvard University, which has accepted a huge donation from a Russian oligarch. And, you know, Professor Michael Porter was consulting to the Gaddafi regime. This is a constant battle. And I think the rise of kleptocracies and the growth of these kinds of clients that don't have the rule of law, and also, you know, the whole pressure on consulting firms and investment banks to, you know, to win the race in for the ultra rich is putting a lot of pressure on our ethics. And those of us who care about these institutions have to keep reminding them that we're alumni and we care about these values and we'll fight for the values that we used to have.
Well, James Henry, I thank you very much for joining us, and Caitlin Rosenthal. And again, James Henry is an economist, lawyer, and investigative journalist who has written extensively about global banking, debt crises, tax havens, and economic developments. The former chief economist at McKinsey & Company, he is the founder with David K. Johnson of the new investigative reporting news service, dcreport.org, and is the author of Blood Bankers. And Caitlin Rosenthal is a professor of history at the University of California, Berkeley, who researches the development of management practices, especially those based on data analysis. Previously a consultant with McKinsey & Company, she's the author of Accounting for Slavery, Masters in Management, and has an article at the Washington Post, The Perils of Big Data, How Crunching Numbers Can Lead to Moral Blunders. Thank you both.
Very well.
Thank you.
This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available at backgroundbriefing.org, where we have just made it easier for you to sign up for email updates as well as subscribe wherever you get your podcast. If you like this program, we encourage you to rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, and SoundCloud. And please do share today's program with friends, family, and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook. We've also made it easier for you to help us sustain our mission, spread the word, and keep us corporate and commercial free by adding a donation button. So if you are in a position to give support, please take a moment and visit backgroundbriefing.org/donate, where your tax-deductible contributions will help us continue to make America think again. Bye for now.